All right, BradCooney.com, in association with HCN Networks, is absolutely honored to have on board Bigfoot researcher Cliff Barrickman from the hit TV show Finding Bigfoot. Cliff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Brad. I appreciate it.
Really appreciate you doing this, man. First and foremost, really love the TV show, man. Talk a little bit about that. The show's doing well, I'm guessing.
Yeah, the show is doing very well. As you and I are speaking, I know this is recorded, so I can't really say that when somebody's going to listen to it, but the day that you and I are speaking is a few days before our new season premiere on Thursday, the 31st of March, 2016. And that was just a big deal for us because we've always been on Sunday nights. And for whatever reason, the network has now switched to the Thursday nights, which I think is going to be a good move for the show. I believe we're following river monsters in general. So it's going to be an excellent night because there's so much competition on Sundays, you know, between, you know, so many networks and, you know, the award shows and things that happen, and Sunday night football and whatnot. So we're looking forward to finding our new home on Thursday nights now.
Yeah, that's great, man. And I think Thursday will work better. I think a lot of people on Sunday evenings are at church services, and you'll have, I think you'll get better ratings, in fact.
Yeah, yeah, and looking forward to it, just to see how that changes things. And, of course, our season premiere is a two-hour special, so even throw more change into the mix. That particular episode will air at 9 o'clock as opposed to our usual 10 o'clock slot.
Excellent. Now, you guys recently came through Mississippi. Will the Mississippi episode be on this season coming up?
Yes, sir, yes. In fact, I was just filming a couple extra called pickup shots the other day for it. So I think that one is scheduled for, goodness, something like 3 weeks from now.
Nice.
I know that the opener is going to be the Mount Shasta episode, and then I think we go to Klamath Falls after that, and then probably Mississippi after that. But really, scheduling all that stuff is way outside my league, I guess. You know, that's a network thing. I just look for Bigfoot.
Absolutely, man. Well, look, I mean, I was at the town hall, and there were so many people there. I don't even think everybody got in. There was so many people that showed up. So obviously, there's a massive interest in Sasquatch, and that's why we have you on board. So I guess I really want to start off with you telling us exactly what really piqued your interest in pursuing Bigfoot, to find out what's going on with Bigfoot.
I've always been an unusual kind of eccentric person, even as a child, you know. But once I figured out in college that, you know, there's a lot of evidence for these things. It's not just people saying it, because that's evidence in one way. That's very soft evidence is what they call it. But there's actually kind of hard evidence for this, you know, not only in the footprints and stuff, but there's also cultural evidence, which really, you know, stretched my head at the time, I guess, back in my early 20s, when I started looking into, like, how Native Americans have names for these things, no matter where the tribes are, you know, no matter where it is in North America that Sasquatches and humans overlapped even before European contact, the natives there knew about them. And if this whole thing was made up, that shouldn't be the case, you know. And I think I'm personally drawn to the Sasquatch thing because I've always loved monsters, and they're kind of representative of monsters, you know, hairy men and stuff. I've always loved camping. I've always loved the woods at night. And this is, like, one of those great mysteries that you can actually do something about. As far as, like, UFOs and stuff go, I'm not a UFO guy. I don't really know much about it, but it seems to me you just kind of sit around and look up for a long time. But this is something you can actually go out and make some noise and look for prints and see if they call back. It's a tangible mystery that we can influence, and I think that is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so you guys get 1.5 million of these sightings. How difficult is it for you when you talk to somebody who says they saw one? How difficult is it for you to determine whether or not this is something that's a hoax or if it's a legit Bigfoot sighting that someone's telling you about?
I try to rely on my public teaching skills because I was an elementary school teacher for 14 years before I started working on the show. And, you know, what I find in general is that whether you're 10 years old or 48, you're kind of the same person, and you show the same manners, and you show the same, like, nonverbal communications and that sort of thing. So I kind of look for those telltale signs of like, a 10-year-old lying if they're telling stories and stuff. You know, how nervous are they? What do their eyes do? What does their body language communicate? and they just want to tell me or tell a researcher what they saw. I personally am not so jaded to think that the vast majority of everybody who says they saw a Bigfoot are lying. I think that says something about a person's outlook when they say, oh no, 95% of this stuff is nonsense. Well, that says something about that researcher, I think, that kind of a dark, gloomy outlook. But the bit of good news is that statistics kind of takes care of that. Bad data usually does creep into any data set, but the overwhelming amount of good data kind of makes those bad ones negligible. So, you know, back 10 years ago, I don't know how many reports Matt's group, the BFRO, has now. I haven't been a member in a long time, so I haven't seen the database, but back in the day, it was like 40,000 people say that they've submitted, 40,000 people submitted a report saying that they saw something. Okay, so maybe half of those are lies or fabrications or exaggerations or something like that. That's still like 20,000 people saying these things. That's more than enough data to determine patterns. And that data, when you graph it out and such, really shows a natural tendency. Like, if it was random and hoaxed, then the points should be all over the map. But no, you get sort of bell curves and like foot sizes and things, and it really is a natural pattern that develops when you start working with the data. The same kind of pattern that develop when you're working with bear data or fish data, for that matter. Nature has a way of showing itself through numbers, and you can see that in the Bigfoot data.
How smart are these things? I'm guessing that since nobody, thank God, nobody's shot one yet, and I hope that never happens, no one's captured one yet. So that would, and I believe, I'm a firm believer in Bigfoot, so with me being a believer, it tells me that these things must be pretty intelligent to be able to be so elusive.
Yeah, they are very intelligent, at least as intelligent as the other great apes. But they're all on a gradient somewhere or another, you know, with gibbons probably being the least intelligent of them all. And, of course, depending on the kind of test, sometimes chimpanzees come out on top of bonobos or even orangutans sometimes, depending on the kind of test. And I think that's something that should be emphasized here, is that what we view as intelligence may not be the same kind of intelligence as they have. You know, that they have, because we view intelligence as like, you know, making lots of money and driving cars, you know, and making fire and using calculators. Well, that's not what they have. So in that level of intelligence, they're below us somewhere, but they're darn smart. You know, I think they're counting. They probably have some sort of rudimentary language abilities or proto-language abilities. But as far as like staying out of sight in the woods and utilizing their environment to the best of their ability to stay alive and warm and fed, they're far smarter than we will ever be. So it's the kind of intelligence that you have to look at. In some ways, they excel way past us. In other ways, they approach us but not quite reach us.
Yeah, you know, a friend of mine brought up a good point the other day. We were talking about this, and when something is, you know, native to an environment like Bigfoot is, it doesn't even have to be so much an intelligence factor. It's just that they're, you know, genetically able to, you know, then for example, how many snakes do you walk past in the woods and never even know about it, like a copperhead, or you just walk on by and it just luckily it didn't strike you, but by golly, it was there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, what we need to remember is that every animal alive today is the culmination of billions of years of evolution.
Right.
They are the survivors. They are the winners of the race. So when you look at like a house fly or something, and we can think of ourselves as being so superior to house flies in every way. Well, really, house flies have come out that way through billions of years of just fine manipulation in their genes, and they are the winners. They are the most advanced version of that house fly to ever exist in all the universe. So it gets a little touchy, I guess, when you start comparing species to species, because you got to remember that every species, humans, Sasquatches, houseflies, we're all the biological winners of the race so far. And all of us, humans might be an exception because we started doing some weird stuff about 12,000 years ago. But Sasquatches are the culmination of all that evolutionary intelligence at its present state. So they're perfectly adapted for what they do in every way.
Yeah. Now let me ask you this. Has the betterment of technology increased the amount of sightings through drones and through infrared and game cameras. I saw a really, really badass game camera photo of a Bigfoot maybe holding an infant one not too long ago. Has that increased?
We're certainly getting more photographs of it because of technology. I can think of, off the top of my head, five or in-cam photographs that I think are legit, many of which have never seen the light of day, actually. Mm. So there are some excellent ones out there. And certainly I can think back to a young man we met in our New York, Whitehall, New York episode, a guy named Ian Gill, who saw one of these things crossing the streets, and he quickly pulled out his iPhone 5 and snapped a picture of it on the side of the road. We would have never got that picture, obviously, unless technology has risen to the level it is now. I'm not sure that, in some ways technology is increasing the number of sightings, but it certainly is increasing the number of individual bits of evidence that have been collected, that's for sure. Because people are seeing them more through thermal imagers now that thermal imagers have dropped in price to the point where some of the, some normal Joes basically can go out and grab them for a couple $100 from FLIR and put them on their iPhone, and they can now start seeing what's in the woods. Actually, a couple of my friends just saw a Sasquatch about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, over in the Coast Range of Oregon through a thermal imager. They would have never seen it if it wasn't for that technology.
That's right. What are some known characteristics that Bigfoots display? I mean, I see you guys in a TV show with tree knocks, things like that. Is there anything, any other characteristics that really stick out?
Behaviors, you mean?
Yes.
Obviously, tree knocks and calls and stuff like that are kind of the easiest way to see it from the area. They don't always answer, even if they are, though. That's a little problematic. But there's just so many little nuances of their behavior that I could talk about. I mean, things like the castle and moat. That's our name for for the Sasquatch tendency to keep a barrier between the humans and the Sasquatch, even when they're hiding from us. Like, so a Sasquatch might be on the other side of a river or something like that in the brush and be seen, but there's going to be they're going to be like holding up in their castle, and there's going to be a river between us, which represents the moat situation where we are. There's always a defensible space between the Sasquatch and humans, almost always. And even if you look at the Patterson-Gimlin film, now she was surprised. Roger Bob came around that big root ball, and she stood up and started walking away. But where did she go? Where did she start walking to? She walked to the nearest place where she can put that log jam in the trees in between her and Roger and Bob. Hmm. The Sasquatches have a very strong inclination to put some sort of barrier, whether it's those trees, a root wad, a river, maybe a steep ledge, maybe a wall of brambles, maybe a cliff face, something between themselves and the humans. Again, that's called castle and moat. That's what we call it.
So, very interesting. What about yourself? How many experiences have you had? Have you seen one with your own eyes?
I saw something that was either a Sasquatch or a human being through a thermal imager in the Uwharrie National Forest in North Carolina. It was clearly one of those two things. There's no possibility it was a bear or anything like that. It was either a human being or a Sasquatch. The clincher is it was about 2:30 in the morning. Mm-hmm. We're about a mile and a half, 2 miles off trail, and it was navigating a wooded hillside in the middle of the night without a light. We also had vocalizations off that same hillside about 45 minutes later. But to be fair, I didn't see with my own eyes. I saw it through a thermal imager. It walked very strangely. It kind of like from the waist up, its arms kind of moved like it was scooping, kind of. Like if you ever like walked in the shallow end of a pool and kind of used your arms to propel yourself to swim while you're walking in waist-deep water, it was kind of moving like that from the waist up. And then from the waist down, it was the legs were moving like it was riding a bicycle almost. It was a very unusual gait. Not at all like the Patterson-Gimlin film subject, but not human-like either. So I don't know what it is that I saw, but if I have seen a Sasquatch, that was it for sure. But other than that, I've tracked them, I've smelled them, I've had rocks thrown at me, I've heard them, either knocks or howls, dozens of times. I've gotten very close to them on a number of occasions. I've been around the big guys, but only been lucky enough to maybe see one once.
I'm guessing that was one. I mean, what human would be out in the middle of nowhere at 2:30 in the morning with no lights?
I don't know. I mean, the other side of that coin is I was told that supposedly, you know, like Navy SEALs, they might have been doing operations that night where they get dropped in one part of the National Forest and have to make it to the other without being seen.
Oh.
But it seems to me like, why would the guy be standing out in the wide open like that? See, I don't know. There's a lot of factors contributing to that that make me just say, like, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I really don't know if that was a Sasquatch, although I tend to think it probably was.
What kind of
fair and honest, which is the most important thing I can do, is to be honest.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What are some sounds they make? On the show, of course, is we see you guys doing the calls, but is there any other sounds? Do they snort? What are the sounds?
Yeah, there's a wide variety of vocalizations that they make, probably almost as wide as the vocalizations you and I make. Because they do seem to be saying something to one another. I've spoken to several witnesses that have heard them kind of going back and forth to each other. You know, I've heard some very interesting recordings taken by people I know, like in Michigan and some other locations, where it sounds like a very low voice saying something very slow that I've never heard before. You know, like, stuff like that. I've heard them in the woods. They sound yelling like a, I compare it to like a someone who doesn't know a language, you know, or someone just doesn't. You ever seen Young Frankenstein?
I have.
You know that scene where he goes, put it on the ridge.
Yes.
It reminds me of that. You know, like someone who doesn't have a good command of language, just going out in the woods. They do that. They scream high pitched, kind of very similar to orangutans sometimes. I've heard them sounding like howler monkeys out in the woods. You know, like, whoop, whoop, whoop,
yeah,
that sort of thing. They have such a wide variety of vocalizations, it's hard to even, you know, begin to go at it. Sometimes they come up outside your tent and do, like, the long, like, Moneymaker calls it the almighty exhale. I've heard Mike Green refer to it as the Darth Vader breath, where they're just like, long exhale thing that lasts like 4 to 8 seconds.
That'd be terrifying.
Could I possibly do it?
That would be absolutely terrifying.
It absolutely is. Absolutely, But yeah, so they have a huge variety of vocalizations, of course. You know, and who knows what if any of that holds meaning or symbolic thought behind it or whatever. I'm assuming it does at this point. But I think that's a study for future generations.
What do you think about family size? Do they have any way we know if they have, you know, large families, small families, and also as far as when they travel? Do they travel independently, or are they more of a pack type traveler?
Well, we have some data that indicate that they live in family groups, which is one of the more common primate family structures and social structures. These and gorillas, they travel in troops, you know, 10, 20 individuals, maybe more sometimes. Orangutans seem to have like a harem situation where there's one male and maybe four or five females spread out in a smaller area, maybe 5 miles or something in the trees, and the male goes and visits each of the females and stuff. And it seems that something like that might be going on with Sasquatches, and that is based on not only sighting encounters but also footprint evidence. It seems that very often one big male will be in an area where there's a female, and then that same big male's footprints might be found up to 60 miles away with some other females. And in that particular case, I'm talking about in late 1950s, early 1960s in Bluff Creek, California. That original Sasquatch, the first one that had ever had its footprints cast, that gave us the word Bigfoot in 1958 by Jerry Crew, that individual Sasquatch, his footprints were found in Bluff Creek area one part of the year, and then 60 miles away in Higham Palm, California, another type of the year, but associated with a different female print, assuming that it was a female print. It was certainly smaller anyway. So, and since primates and great apes in particular have a sexual dimorphism, which means that the males are bigger than females, it's safe to say that that smaller print was probably a female. There's also some interesting recurring individuals in the Blue Mountain evidence collected by Paul Freeman, Wes Summerlin, Dar Addington, Dr. Mayan Zinsky, Dr. Meltram. All those people were taken prints out of the Blue Mountains of Oregon and Washington. And when you look closely at that data, Yeah. I don't know that. We're still collecting data on that.
Yes, it seems like that, though. It seems like there's enough to deduce that so far.
Yeah, there are very few bits of data, but what we do have is pointing that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And again, sighting reports kind of bring that up as well. You know, people who see the same individual Sasquatches over a period of time, called long-term witnesses, they live in a certain area. It turns out Bigfoots kind of live nearby, too, so they see the same ones. What they're reporting also kind of shows that, you know, the same ones come back, so they see the same males, the same females, and sometimes even have the opportunity to watch the little ones grow over time. I think we have a family group situation, but it's too early to tell for sure.
What's the most prolific, exciting piece of evidence you've seen and you've investigated that's gotten you the most excited?
Oh, gosh. There's so many good ones. I mean, when you say prolific, you know, that just means keep appearing, keep creating more, keep giving. That has to be the Patterson-Gimlin film, just because, you know, it was taken in 1967 and new information is still being squeezed out of it today. So as far as being prolific, that particular piece of data is super interesting and is a gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
And of course, going to the site with Bob Gimlin himself is definitely one of my top 10 things I've ever done in my life. And Bob's a good friend of mine, of course, you know, but being at the site with Bob is a different deal altogether. That's it's like, I don't know, it's history, you know, and to be there with the guy that made it was pretty amazing.
And, you know, that video to this day, I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was just saying that video you're talking about, it's you know, it's a world renowned video. It's very difficult to debunk that even with today's technology, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually, the more people study it, the more people come out the other side with the conclusion that it's real. The most recent and by far the best effort was by Bill Munns. Bill Munns is a creature makeup artist and a special effects guy, and he also makes museum quality sort of taxidermy replicas of animals. But most importantly, he was actually working in the film industry in the late 1960s when the Patterson-Gimlin film was obtained. So for the last 10 years or 5 years or something, I don't know how long, but Bill has been really closely studying the Patterson-Gimlin film in every aspect you can imagine off of it, and trying to replicate suits or parts of suits that would show the same details and movements that you see in the film. And he published a great book called When Roger Met Patty, based about his studies of the Patterson-Gimlin film. And he kind of went into it thinking that he's going to be able to show this thing as a hoax because of his expertise in costumes and such, you know, because he actually made costumes for movies and things. But he actually, once he started studying the film and seeing what was actually in it, he came to the conclusion that, yeah, it's real. Oh, my gosh, this is real. So he just kept pushing his experiments and pushing his studies. And I think if anybody reads When Roger Met Patty, they're going to decide, like, holy smokes, the film is absolutely real. So,
well, it's even further than just the appearance. Isn't it also the gait? It would be very, very difficult for a human to you know, to mimic how it walked, the foot span.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Meldrum actually did a study. He did it for some TV show or something like that. And what he did is he got a professional dancer, if I remember correctly, to try to replicate the movements in the film. The gait. You know, he was on a treadmill, and they put those like little like points on all of his joints. You know, like on his elbow and knee and stuff. And then they did the same thing in the film, and said, no, you need to walk a little bit more like this. And they did a computer analysis of this guy trying to replicate the PG walk. And he eventually could, but this professional dancer said it was very difficult to maintain, super hard to do, and not something he'd certainly want to do in a suit by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, this creature that we see in the film just smoothly glides across the sandbar as if it's no big deal at all.
Effortless.
And that gait, when you analyze it, actually that gait, efficient way of moving a mass that size than our own style of walking. You know, with that net, that bent knee compliant gait that the Patterson-Gimlin film subject shows is a better way and a more efficient way to move than our own mode of locomotion.
Hmm.
So, I mean, there's a lot to look at in that film. Then you have the footprint evidence.
Wow.
And the footprint evidence anticipated discoveries about ape feet and Sasquatch feet that wouldn't be made until 1996. But yet here we have these footprints taken in 1967 that show the signature, if you will, of morphological features in the foot that hadn't even been discovered yet in the Sasquatch foot. So,
wow.
Again, that everything about that film is congruent with itself, you know, congruent with other data that's been collected. Everything from the bendable foot in the mid part of the foot to the elongated heel to the compliant gait to the intermembral index. It's a phenomenal piece of evidence.
Unbelievable. Hopefully we'll get some fresh new video like that soon as definitive, you know. That would just be amazing.
It's kind of a bum out that it happened so early in the game, actually.
Yeah.
Some of that quality is going to be extremely difficult to duplicate. But it'll happen eventually. I've seen some pretty interesting things out there. Don't quite match the Patterson-Gimlin film, but there's some excellent evidence out there.
It's almost like the Bigfoot said, all right, you guys had your Super Bowl with that one slip-up. You know, we're not going to give you no more.
Right. And I do have friends, Tom Powell, for example, who leans more towards the paranormal. That I think is necessary, but he's a good friend of mine. Actually, he's over at my house last night. We had dinner together.
Awesome.
But he says that Bigfoot did that early just to play a joke on us behind all that, and you know that's one of the things they did. They planted good evidence early that we'll never be able to again, just to mess with us.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Maybe he's right. I don't know.
Who knows?
I think he is, but maybe he is.
All right. So I have a question from one of the fans out there that watches the show. I asked the folks out there on the BFRO Facebook page for some questions, and this gentleman's name is James, and he is from Tupper Lake, New York, and he wants to know, do Sasquatch bury their dead? Is that why we have not found a corpse?
Well, it's possible. I personally don't think they do. I've read or heard a very, very small number of reports that might indicate that, so I'm keeping that as an open possibility. I think that the reason we don't find their dead corpses is that it's for the same reason we don't find naturally dead mountain lion corpses or naturally dead bear corpses. We find ones that were shot by people, but not naturally dead ones. And I've got an article actually on my website in the frequently asked section about that particular question. But basically, the short version is that an animal gets sick one day, and this is an animal that has a natural death. That's an important distinction, because if an animal is shot, like a bear is poached or a deer or something, it just dies wherever it dies. It has no choice in the matter. But an animal that is going about the natural process of dying probably chooses where they die, because like every other time in their life, they just feel ill and they have to go get better. So they stash themselves away in a really thick stuff somewhere. And then instead of getting better one day, they die, you know, like all animals do eventually. And so within a few hours to a few days, the scavengers move in and start dispersing the body parts. You know, weasels and coyotes and whatevers come in and start chewing up the body and moving it around and taking the arm over here and taking the leg over here and stuff. And pretty soon the meat will be gone, the hair will be consumed by moths, and then what you have are the bones. Well, it turns out bones are eaten by not only coyotes and porcupines, and even deer eat bone to get calcium out of their antlers. But the most common animal by biomass in North America is the deer mouse. They eat bones too.
Mm.
The most common animal out there is actually eating the bones, and wood rats eat bones, and everything eat bones, really. And besides that, you know, even if you were walking off trail somewhere and you came across a femur, like some big bone or something like that, about 2.5 feet long, you wouldn't automatically think it was a Sasquatch.
That's true.
You would think it was something else far more common.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably wouldn't bring it back to a university, convince a scientist, and pay for a DNA test to see if it was. So it's possible that bones have been found in the past and just weren't recognized for what they were. There's even a skull that was kicked up from a mud puddle back in the 60s or 40s or something in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains that might have been a Sasquatch. It is presently in a warehouse in Chatsworth, California, and it belongs to UCLA. This skull is called the Minaret Skull. Matt Moneymaker wrote an excellent article about it and did research on it while he was attending UCLA. He tracked down, he didn't track down the skull, but he tracked down records on the skull and comments made by anthropologists, how it was much too big to be a human, how it had a sagittal crest, which is that ridge that apes have on top of their head.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually some anthropologists saw it and said, no, it's a deformed Native American, stuck it in a box, and then now we have a Raiders of the Lost Ark situation.
Oh, wow.
Where there's a box with a skull in it with a, you know, 10 or 12 digit number identifying it as a Native American skull, and it's in a warehouse somewhere in Chatsworth, California.
Wow.
So bones might have been discovered, certainly, but the bones are recycled into nature, basically, as I outlined. And also, remember, Sasquatches are extremely rare. Dr. Grover Krantz estimates there's at least 100 bears for every one Bigfoot
mm-hmm.
in most habitat. And considering you don't really find bear bones that were, you know, of a naturally dead bear, one would
true.
Expect to never find Sasquatch bones. So
that's very true. That's a good segue into this next question from Randy. Randy's from Round Rock, Texas. I know where that's at. It's just above Austin. He wanted to know, what's the approximate, do y'all know what the approximate population of Bigfoots in North America is, and how close do you think they come to large city populations?
Well, and of course, no one knows, obviously. Like, a lot of my guesstimates and whatnot is pure speculation based on some information that I have, you know, based on some data.
Mm-hmm.
I think that continent-wide, you know, continent-wide, that's important to keep in mind, because that's talking Canada as well, and even, you know, some parts of Mexico probably have these things. I'm guessing that there are probably somewhere in the range of maybe 10,000 individual Sasquatches, give or take a few thousand, okay? Maybe there's as few as, like, 5 or 6, maybe there's as many as, like, 14 or 15,000, I don't know, which sounds like a lot, but it really isn't, because think about how empty most places in British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and stuff. And there's a lot of nothing up there. And gosh, and when you get into the Yukon and stuff, it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much land, and so these things could be very thinly dispersed. But you know, Dr. Krantz, again, he heavily influenced me in a lot of ways. His book did, but in his book, he talks about he thinks there's about 2,000 individuals in the Pacific Northwest, from Northern California to Southern Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And he points out that even though that sounds like a lot, 2,000 individuals, if you took away all of the paved land in that same area, that's over 275 square miles for each individual Sasquatch.
Wow. That's a lot of,
and considering, as we talked about earlier in the same conversation, Sasquatches don't live isolated existences. They probably live in small family groups. So, 275 square miles for each individual Sasquatch translates to a lot more land if we're talking about family groups, you know?
Mm-hmm.
People may hear my numbers of, you know, a couple thousand for the Pacific Northwest, or 10,000, give or take a few, for the continent. But that, if that sounds like a lot, you're probably, maybe you don't have a firm grasp on how much land there really is available for these things, I guess is a good way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of empty land out there that people are not going in on a regular basis, that Bigfoots could just run free and do their Bigfoot stuff, and no one would ever even see them. There's no one there to see them.
Well, heck, you can just take Wyoming, Montana, parts of Utah, and just throw 3,000 Bigfoot in there, and that would even be rare to see one, just in those three states.
Yeah.
You know?
And I don't think that it would go anywhere near 3,000 individuals. I would imagine that for those three states, we're probably talking, you know, 500 individuals
right.
at the most, or, you know, at the most.
Exactly.
They're just so rare, and that really contributes heavily to the fact that we haven't found any remains of them, how few sighting reports surface. And I think the people who are seeing these things are probably seeing a lot of the same Sasquatches again and again.
Yeah, that's true.
They're just so rare. I used to think that there were a lot more of them, actually, until I started studying the footprint data in depth. It was amazing to me that there's probably fewer of these things than I was initially thinking. And that's based on recurring individuals in the same area. You know, like the Blue Mountain evidence, for example, that there's like maybe 40 or 50, maybe 60 footprints out of that area. And you're basically looking at about 5 or 6, 7 individuals, maybe.
Wow.
That many. The 1960s Bluff Creek evidence.
Interesting. The other part of his question, he asked about how close they come
to the cities and stuff.
You know, but I'm from Mayapack, New York, which is roughly 50 miles or so from New York City. But man, we had a lot of thick woods and country in my part of New York. So I'm guessing they can come fairly close to cities.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, if we're talking New York City, I mean, we ran into a Sasquatch at Fonstock State Park, about 45 minutes from New York City.
There you go.
From Manhattan.
Wow.
I live inside the city limits of Portland, Oregon, not too far from the airport. And there were sightings 12 miles from my house in Oxbow Park.
Wow. There you go.
They inhabit whatever available habitat there is. I know people, or I get emails, I correspond with people up in the Kitsap Peninsula that, you know, they're living in these little towns and stuff, and out their back door they're seeing these things sometimes. Bigfoots don't care as much about the cities as people think. No more than bears do and stuff.
Right, right.
Wherever there are, like, bear sightings or mountain lion sightings, you might run across a Bigfoot sighting, too, you know.
Are there any hot spots in parts of the country? Is there more sightings in other spots?
You can find hot spots wherever you go. I mean, people always think the Pacific Northwest is the ultimate hot spot. But actually, that's because we just have so much available habitat for Sasquatches. But when I go back to Pennsylvania or, you know, Ohio, or if I go Bigfooting in any, like, Midwestern states, sometimes the Bigfoots are easier to find there because there's less available habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go to one of the hot spots out there and have just as much, if not more, success than you would out in the Pacific Northwest. There are hot spots everywhere. It's just a matter of where is the Bigfoot right now, and most importantly to me is why are they there? Because if you can find that, if you can find some answers to that question, then maybe you can find Sasquatches in other areas where they're not known to exist.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read online about Dr. Sykes and his, he was going to do some DNA analysis. Can you update the listeners on what, because I read some mixed reviews on that.
Yeah. Dr. Sykes wrote a book and published it recently. Now that he's retired, he's kind of free to explore his more interesting, scientific endeavors and stuff. Because academics working for universities are not encouraged to look at Sasquatches by and large. You know,
yeah.
They're not really encouraged to look outside the mainstream because that's not where funding comes from. You know, funding is all about the mainstream, basically, and making your funders happy. But now that he's retired, he started looking into some Sasquatch stuff and trying to find get to the bottom of it. And through his study, and the book's okay. I've read most of the book at this point. I still haven't made it all the way through it, but I've read most of it. There are some glaring errors. I think he has the wrong date for the Patterson-Gimlin film, for example.
Mm.
So that, of course, causes some concern. And I have great respect for Dr. Sykes, of course, but there are some glaring errors. I think he went back and fixed, actually, because
right.
One should do that. From what I understand is that all of the hair samples that he pulled from North America turned out to be normal animals.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if any of those samples actually were collected after a Sasquatch had been seen, like, say, rubbing its back on something, you know. I think that that's the problem with hair, actually. He's getting mitochondrial DNA out of hair. Hair is one of the most common things you can find in the woods. Like, if you're sitting on the ground in the woods, it's very likely you can get the hair without getting your butt off the ground.
Right.
Like, that's how common hair is. So just finding hair out in the woods, like, oh, I don't recognize this hair. Well, so what? Like, elk, for example, have probably 5 or 6, 7 different kinds of hair on their body, depending on where it came from, if it's the overcoat or the undercoat, is it in their mane, is it in their armpits? Like, look at your own body. Like, we have different kinds of hair all over.
Mm-hmm.
So finding hair in the woods is not a very good way to say that this is the Sasquatch hair. If you saw a Sasquatch rubbing its back on a tree and then went up to that tree and found hair on it, well, then that's a one-to-one correlation, and that's what we really need at this point, because all the Sasquatch samples Dr. Sykes tested turned out to be other things, raccoons and dogs, whatever. I am super interested in his Yeti studies, though, because it was big news when he came out saying that he tested Okay, so cool. Yeah, so for me, that's a positive hit. For the media, who doesn't know any better, they're saying, oh, there is no Bigfoot. You know, like, because there's no Yeti,
right.
There. So, well, no, like, again, we're standing on other people's shoulders. We're not the first Bigfoot researchers to come this way. Any of us are. People have written on this stuff before, and it's our job to read those books and understand the background of where we're coming from, because if any of these people had read those books, they would know that one of the Yetis that's reported is a bear. So, yeah, it's a positive hit. Congratulations to Dr. Sykes for proving that. Now let's go find ourselves an ape.
Yeah, good stuff. You know, I saw some pictures of footprints in the snow, and the tracks were like a tightrope. It didn't have the human type gait where you'd see, you know, a pair of footprints. It was just one, you know what I'm saying, one tightrope. Is that how they walk? Do they walk where they swing their foot in front of the other one like that to make it one line?
Yes, they do that. Not always, because, again, you don't always walk one way either. There are individuals, they do what they want to do. What it seems to me, based on footprint trails that I've either observed or have pictures of and stuff, is that when Sasquatches are going somewhere, like, it seems like they've got a place to be, or they're trying to get out of an area, like in the Patterson-Gimlin Films case, their foot track lines have very little straddle, is what that's called.
Right.
They kind of walk in that tightrope way, very little straddle. But at the same time, Sasquatches have been observed, and I've seen trackways that the feet are kind of side by side like us, and the step lengths are not very large, because they're not really going anywhere. And then it doesn't always have a tightrope style walking in that case. But it does seem that when they're really going someplace and they've got to get out of the area, or they're walking someplace, the feet are like one in front of another.
Yeah.
And that very likely has to do with centering, their center of gravity.
Yeah.
Because being such a large, massive biped, if they're waddling kind of back and forth, that would kind of be very stressful on their muscles and skeleton, right, for support. But yet if they can center their center of gravity while they propel themselves forward, then that'll actually help them. And that's also something that we need to look at for the Patterson-Gimlin film subject. It's a female, but yet it has kind of narrow hips. And that would be a redesign of the muscle and skeletal structure to kind of weight, to kind of, again, center that center focus of gravity so the creature doesn't have to expend more energy keeping itself upright.
Awesome. Well, look, man, I had a lot of fun doing this. I know you're a busy guy, so we're going to cut this one short. Before I let you go, though, I want to just recap. The show is on Animal Planet. It's going to be on Thursday, the premiere. Can you give us a date again when it premieres?
The premiere is on the 31st of March at 9 o'clock. And this particular episode is a lot of fun, actually, because not only do we go to Mount Shasta, where we've never been before, but we team up with a team of paranormal Bigfooters.
Oh, nice.
Our group isn't all that paranormal. You know, Bobo's a little out there sometimes. But these guys are all kind of out there. So we team up with another team of paranormal Bigfooters, and we take one of theirs, and we give them one of ours.
Oh, wow.
Separate groups to do investigations. And it is, I watched the episode just a couple days ago, and it is super funny. It's pretty squashy at the same time. And then we got some interesting things on the thermal imager as well. So it is a great episode.
It was a good teaser, folks. You know, I met Bobo when you guys, of course, I met you when you were in Jackson, Mississippi. Bobo looks great. Bobo looks great. Lost some weight, and he looks really good. He's feeling good these days, isn't he?
Yeah, he is looking good. I think he lost like 65 pounds or something.
Yeah, he looked great.
I just saw Bobo the other day, too, and he's keeping it off. He's looking healthy and happy, and he's doing very, very well. A lot of people are concerned for Bobo because, hey, he looks like he's dropped a lot of weight. Is he okay? Well, yeah, he's better than ever now.
Yeah.
Lost that weight. He's taking care of himself.
Awesome.
He's exercising. He's eating way healthier than any of the rest of us are. We're all really proud of Bobo, and we love the guy, and we're super stoked that he's, like, doing so much better now, because it's not like he was doing bad before, but, you know, all that extra weight takes a toll, especially on big guys, you know, so dropping all that weight and really loving yourself like that makes a huge difference, and I just couldn't be happier for my friend. So,
you know, and I wanted to congratulate you guys, because when you came through here in Mississippi, man, I mean, you couldn't ask for a bunch of more friendly or fan-friendly guys. And Renee also. It's not all guys. Renee was awesome. Renee was picking up babies and taking pictures, and Bobo was so approachable and talked to everybody and took pictures, and you and Matt. I mean, it was just a great experience. I really wanted to tell you that before I cut you loose.
Well, thank you. And, you know, speaking for myself only, I recognize that I am blessed with a ridiculously cool job.
Yeah.
And it won't be here forever, but the reason that we're doing this at all is because the fans watch the show.
Sure.
And there's no skin off our back to take a picture and smile for somebody or make somebody's day. Because really, life is about spreading smiles. You know, and if you can spread a little joy in your day-to-day thing and talk to somebody, listen to the Bigfoot Report, take a picture with them, sign something, whatever, it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way to give back to the fans who have given us so much.
Well, you guys sure did that. Okay, before I let you go, share your social sites, your website, where people can go pick up merchandise and things like that.
Yeah, I've got DVDs for sale. Not finding Bigfoot stuff, but stuff that I found on my own, and hats and shirts and stuff. Yeah, just go to my website at cliffberrickman.com, and that's probably the best way. You can find portals to all sorts of articles that I've written. A lot of evidence is analyzed on my site, far more in depth than we have time to do on the show. I write like my Cliff Notes, my field research.